Hi, I'm Mike Sklenz, and this is Nintendo World Report's Connectivity Podcast, Episode 75, present podcast of Melodic Offworlder. On our first segment, Scott and Zach answer some listener mail questions, and after that, Tyler joins them for a discussion of Runner 2. We've also got a bonus segment with Scott and Johnny about outer space.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. Today, I'm joined by Zachary Miller.
It's the Zach and Scott show again.
Once again, we're back for more. We didn't burn the whole place down last time, so we thought we could try this one more time. Today, we're going to read some listener mail, talk about some Twitter topic suggestions, and then move right along. Yep. So it shouldn't be too bad. We have three emails that we've gotten over the past couple weeks. I'll read this first one. It's actually a response in episode 73. We did the, like games that are tied to important moments in our life type thing. And, we got a response with someone sharing his, kind of game that's tied to an important moment in his life that he'll always kind of remember. So this is Ryan from Anaheim, California. Go Ducks. And he says, I just finished listening to episode 73 and I have a story about a non-Nintendo game that will forever be associated with a time in my life. This might not be a story you'll want to read on the show. Well, I'm going to do it anyway because it's kind of a downer. The game is Borderlands and it's what I was playing when my father was dying last year. Oh, I won't go into all the details, but I'm sure you understand or can at least imagine what it's like to have a close family member fade from your sight. It's hard to go about your normal life as if nothing is wrong. During this dark time, out of the blue, my brother-in-law decided we were going to play Borderlands. At the time, it seemed like a silly thing to do, but he understood that I needed something to escape into, to get my mind off of things I couldn't control. He is able to be there for my sister, but I'm alone and have no one to lean on. I think he figured he could be there for me if we played a game online. So for the following months, we played Borderlands, and it was a blessing. My adventures on Pandora couldn't solve my problems, but it helped me endure the difficult time. For that reason, Borderlands will always be a special game to me. I'll always associate it with that time in my life, but not in a bad way because it was a good thing when almost everything seemed so terrible. Dad passed away 2 days before Christmas, and soon after, we started playing Borderlands 2. And that is what he wrote. Yeah, that's pretty tough. Now, I wanted to specifically talk about this because, Zach, I know, you know, you spent your fair share of time in the hospital.
Yes.
Has there ever been a particular game that it's kind of... Yeah, I don't know, that you've kind of spent a lot of time with while being in the hospital, or just games in general, or...
When I was a young man, a younger boy, the hospital had a console on a rolling cabinet, and it was a Super Nintendo,
mm-hmm.
and it had Star Fox in it,
oh.
and I don't know how old I was, maybe 12 or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was in there for a week, maybe 10 days, because... When you're that young, they keep you in there instead of sending you home with an IV.
Mm-hmm.
And I played the hell out of Star Fox. And that was really, really fun. I also played, and Johnny will like this, at a previous day, I played a lot of Mylan's Secret Castle.
Oh, okay.
Could
sure.
not figure that game out, but damn, I liked it.
That was NES, right?
Yeah, NES.
I think I have that game. I think, you know, it's weird. I think one time I tried to buy... on eBay, like a gold cartridge, the original Zelda, or maybe it was Zelda 2, and he was like, sorry, I ran out, but here, have this.
Have Mylon instead.
Yeah, I was like, okay, not really what I bought, but okay.
Do you know if Mylon is on the virtual console?
No, but...
I don't think it is. I'd like it to be.
I could tell you right now. I don't think it is.
Okay. So those two games, but then, I don't know, the older I got, like, the last few years I've been in the hospital... more often, and you know, I just kind of played my 3DS here and there. Last time I was in the hospital, I was reviewing Coda Princess, so I played a lot of that. But as for seared into my mind memories, it's Star Fox and Mylon.
Sure, and it is on the virtual console. It came out in 2007.
Oh, hell yes.
So, yeah, I mean, that it was a year after launch. I mean, within the first year of launch, that's pretty wild.
I'm going to buy that.
Yeah, there you go.
And read a FAQ.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you?
With what, games in the hospital?
Well, games associated with, yeah, I guess hospitals.
Well, as I say, I mean, I've never really, you know, I haven't had ever an extended stay in the hospital for myself.
True.
when Tegan was born, we were in the hospital for 2 days after that, just doing the whole, you know, hang out in the hospital for 2 days after your baby's born type thing. I mean, nothing was wrong, but that's just what you do. You stay in the hospital for, you know, a day or two afterwards. And I brought Pokemon White, I think I had, or probably Black. Well, whichever one I had. I played a lot of that, but it wasn't necessarily memorable. It was just sort of something to do while we were in the hospital. So, no, I had no particular game tied to hospital stays necessarily.
There was a letter I read that was posted on a lot of game news sites not too long ago, maybe a few weeks. It was a girl wrote in to the producers or the director of Journey, and she wrote in and said that her dad was dying of cancer in the hospital, and he was on his last few days, and they played Journey together, and they both loved it, and now she can't turn on the game and get to the title screen without weeping.
No.
And I thought that was a nice story.
Yeah, that is.
Also depressing.
It is, but
nice.
You know,
nice.
Yeah. It's life, I suppose. You know, that stuff happens.
And Journey, you know, it's a good game to play when you're on your deathbed.
Right. I think so. Because, yeah, I would agree with that. It's not, you know, it's not like Call of Duty.
Oh, I just mean the Journey itself. You've played the game, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, yeah. I have. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, you know, there's like some meaning behind it. I think at the end of it, you're kind of like, I don't know, you feel almost better for having played it.
Call of Duty would be anyway. An interesting last game.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. Well, thank you, Ryan, for sharing the story.
A good story.
That is. Hopefully you weren't also looking forward to Aliens Colonial Marines as a way to sort of bridge the gap since it's the same developer.
Oh, my gosh, that's true. Well, according to all the news I've been reading, not really.
Yeah, that's true. In name alone, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, although I guess Borderlands 2 is better for it because it sounds like a lot of money from Aliens Colonial Marines went there.
Got sunk into that. Have you played that Aliens game yet, Scott?
Honestly, I will at some point. I think it's on Steam. I'm sure at some point it'll be on sale or something.
Oh, see, I thought you pre-ordered it.
No, I didn't.
Oh, no.
I don't really pre-order anything. I think it's kind of a scam. I mean, it's not like these things ever run out. Maybe like some weird Atlas game or something at some point, but this kind of stuff, no. Especially when I would just play it on my computer and just download it. So
true.
Yeah. But I've played all the other Aliens games. I love the Aliens, you know, films and everything. So like part of me just feels like I have to just to kind of just know and see it.
Catch
like,
up
I feel
with
obligated.
Them.
Yeah, but I'm in no rush to play a really terrible game for $60.
Did you play the Alien Trilogy, that first-person shooter for, like, the 3DO or something?
It was for the Jaguar. It's funny that this has come up again, because Andy and I talked about this before on a segment.
Oh, nice.
It was, like, our Halloween segment, like, scary game segment.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
With the facehuggers.
Exactly. Well, I didn't play that one, but the PC Alien vs. Predator game, the original Alien vs. Predator on PC,
is
really, really good. And that's the one with like the facehuggers and stuff.
Yeah.
That one's awesome. So I played that. I played AVP2, and then I played the re-release of Aliens vs. Predator that was like on consoles.
Yeah, a few years ago.
Yeah.
Was that
so I played all those. It was okay. Definitely better than Colonial Marine sounds.
Now, did you ever play an old arcade game, possibly by Konami, but I'm not sure, that was like a side-scrolling shooter based on Aliens?
Yeah, well, not a shooter, right? Like the beat-em-up?
Well, no, this wasn't Aliens vs. Predator. This was an Aliens game with a character like Ripley, but it wasn't Ripley. They couldn't get her likeness, so it's a red-headed person.
it was an arcade game?
An arcade game, and it had... Huh. You just kind of walk through the level and you get different weapons, like different weapon drops. So your weapon type switches, and aliens of all kinds come flying at you, and you shoot them.
Huh? No, I've never played that. I played the Alien 3 for Super Nintendo.
Oh
which
yeah,
sounds very similar to what you're describing, actually.
Yeah.
But no, I never played that one actually.
Oh, you should look that up on the internet. It's really cool.
Huh? Yeah,
I sank a lot of quarters into that back in the day.
Yeah, I'll have to do that. I don't even know this one. Was it just called Aliens or?
Yep.
Huh. Okay. I'll check it out. So our next email isn't exactly a question, but we can use it as sort of a jumping off point. It's a little long, but we'll do our best here. So this is from Wilson Robinson, and he says, It's no secret that the Wii U isn't lighting up the sales charts. There seems to be a lot of Nintendo Doom predictions circulating as always, but I find it really odd that so many of these people seem to ignore the fact that every other Nintendo system had a killer app either at launch or just a few weeks after. NES had Mario Brothers, SNES had Mario World, N64 had Mario 64, GameCube had Smash Brothers Melee, and Wii had Wii Sports. Every single one of those games were either available on launch day or soon after, and they were also the best-selling game for their respective system, if I'm not mistaken. Now, Nintendo Land and New Super Mario Bros. U will surely be near the top of the Wii U's bestsellers at the end of its lifespan, but the key difference is that neither are system sellers. It's been frequently discussed that Nintendo Land doesn't convey the message of the Wii U like Wii Sports did for the Wii, which has caused it not to be a must-have title. It simply lacks that I've-gotta-try-it appeal of Wii Sports. In regards to Mario, it may sound strange to some that I don't think New Super Mario Bros. U is a killer app, but allow me to explain. While New Super Mario Bros. Wii sold incredibly well, I would argue that it wasn't a system seller either. It was a title that a lot of casual gamers would see on a store shelf and then buy because they remembered that they have a Wii tucked away and recalled memories of Mario on the NES. The difference between Mario Wii and Mario U is that the former came out after tens of millions of Wiis had already been sold. Mario U will likely sell very well once more people own the Wii U, but it simply isn't a game that's going to make very many people compelled to go out and buy the new system. I know I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, but I think it bears repeating that once the killer apps finally arrive, the Wii U will become Nintendo's latest and greatest hit. Thanks for reading my letter, and sorry it was so long. Your friend, your fan and friend, Wilson Aww. Robinson. Yeah. Thank you, Wilson.
Let's just to say one thing. It wasn't Smash Brothers Melee that was the GameCube system seller. It was Rogue Leader.
Oh, yeah? You think so?
Oh, yeah, because it was a launch game. Melee was not.
But Melee came out in a month. It came out in, that December following.
Well, okay, but I bought my GameCube based solely on Rogue Leader, and I'm sure Rogue a lot Leader. Of other people did, too.
Yeah, I remember just seeing, preview coverage for that game and thinking it looked so amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. It was a very good game, and it did look gorgeous for the time and everything.
Still the best-looking game on Wii.
On Wii? Yeah, that's probably true. I think he's right. I mean, I think that's the problem. There was a lot of good Wii U launch software, but nothing that made you have to buy a Wii U. I'm happy I have a Wii U. I've played some good games, but... If someone, with not a lot of money was like, do I need a Wii U right now? I mean, the answer is no.
No.
You know? I mean, you can live without playing New Super Mario Bros. U. Because he's right. It's another 2D Mario game. It's great that it's there. People can always pick it up. I'm sure it will be continuously one of the Wii U's best, sellers month to month to month. Sure. Just the way that New Super Mario Bros. Was for the DS. But yeah, it's not something you have to run out and get.
No.
But I don't know. I don't know what that game's going to be.
The Nintendo Doom predictions, I mean, after the NPDs, I mean, they're kind of, I can see that.
Right. It's not like these comments that Nintendo's done for are ill-founded or something.
PSP numbers.
Right. I mean, there's good reason to say that stuff, but yeah, I mean, you have to imagine that they'll bounce back.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll bounce back, long after E3 when all those games they promised at the Nintendo Direct they start production on and, actually make.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, it is really weird to me that, and I'm sure we've talked this to death, that they didn't have more in the pipe in the beginning.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that's kind of been a consistent problem over the past few years. I mean,
they weren't making Wii games.
Well, that's exactly my point. I mean, look at the Wii. I mean, of course, when you're launching a new console, you're going to let your other console kind of fade into the night, if you will. But, right. I mean, over the past 2 years, there haven't really been a lot of great Wii releases. I mean, save for a few games that weren't even guaranteed to come over here, like Xenoblade Chronicles and Last Story. I mean, outside of that, you really haven't had any... good first-party games, even.
It's that Kirby collection.
The Kirby collection, right. Exactly. So now you've had this sort of 2 or 3 year span where it seems like Nintendo really hasn't produced much of anything.
Yeah.
So maybe that's good. Maybe there's something really big on the horizon that we'll learn about at E3.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I had a bad feeling about that Nintendo Direct because they were showing off renders.
Right. And
they could have, I think I've said this before, they could have made those the day before.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. No, it wasn't like the 3DS one we just had where it was like a lot of concrete stuff was shown, a lot of stuff that's coming out this year. The Wii one was a lot of just like conceptual stuff.
Yeah, the 3DS one was, this stuff is clearly in development right now.
Right.
Whereas the Wii U one, I felt like, well, we got to do something. Let's give people what they've been asking for a long time. Draw up some pictures, Bob.
Yeah, make Yoshi out of yarn.
Yeah, exactly.
And tell everyone we've got a 3D Mario on the way.
What?
There you go.
What? No.
But yeah, so it is kind of weird. I mean, I feel like they're kind of falling into the trap they fell into with the GameCube, but without Smash Brothers. I mean, I think launching the GameCube with Luigi's Mansion really wasn't the greatest idea, you know, coming from the choice. N64. It just didn't excite people. And you know, they did have Smash Brothers within a month, so that was good. But Pikmin was, I mean, that was the first entry in the series. I don't know that anyone saw Pikmin and was like, I have to get a GameCube for that.
No,
I think it was like a pleasant surprise. And that's what I think a lot of these Wii U games are right now. They're like sort of the games that you would pick up in conjunction with one huge, like, mega hit, and that you would be like, oh, wow, this is good too. These are good games to play alongside this one game I bought the system for.
Right.
But there isn't that one game. Right. Oh, you know, apart from diehards who just want to play every single Mario game or...
Yeah,
we'll just buy anything Nintendo puts out, which is most of us who record this podcast and listen to it. But yeah, we'll see. It's interesting. I think it's a really interesting time for Nintendo. I don't think they're going to go third party within the next 5 years, as some people are predicting. But I do wonder, you know, what they're... I don't know. I mean, it's weird to look so ahead to the next console already, but I wonder what this experience is doing to just their idea of the home console and
interesting to think they might just focus on handhelds next time.
Yeah, but
I've
even
heard
that
theory before too.
Yeah, and you, I guess that's a good point to look at the 3DS, because I think 2 years ago, I mean, the 3DS is 2 years old now. A lot of people were like, you know, you can't launch a handheld anymore. The cell phone market, mobile gaming is so huge. I mean, this is a waste of time. And it seemed like that was going to be the case, that the 3DS was just sort of dead in the water. And now it's incredibly popular, and everyone has a 3DS, and it's reaching that level where the DS was. So who knows?
It's because they started coming out with some games. And
what's
interesting is that just like the Wii U, the 3DS has, like, no Western support.
Right.
And really no third-party support.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, I'm sure the Wii U will pick up. But I think we are starting to see kind of a point of diminishing returns in not just the Nintendo space, but the console space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Especially after that Sony conference. But we can talk about that later.
Sure, absolutely. All right, so let's move on to our third and last letter. It's from Travis. He, in parentheses, T for travesty. I'm assuming that's his NWR handle, or just a cool nickname he likes for himself. And he says, so I just bought Gunman Clive with some spare money I got left over on my 3DS. I was shocked to see how good a $2 game could be. This game is awesome. Anyway, I was wondering, what were some of the best games you guys got on the cheap lately? Also, what were some of the worst games you guys paid full retail for? Love the show and keep up the great work, Travis. Gunman Clive is awesome.
Yeah.
It is. And I think that's so cool to have a $2 game on the 3DS. I think there should be more of that.
Oh, I agree.
It's just really kind of, I mean, talking about mobile gaming, I mean, that's right in line with what people kind of expect to pay for these types of games. And I think that's great that they were able to do it, that Nintendo didn't make them, you know,
$8 make it, or something.
Yeah, or $5 at least or something. You know, that was cool that they got the price where they did. Games I got on the cheap. Well, I mean, nothing that's just inherently cheap. I mean, I've gotten some good, like, Steam sale stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I got the whole Walking Dead collection for, like, half off or 75% off just when one day on a Steam sale. So, yeah, I paid, like, under $10 for the whole thing, which is awesome because those games are so good. Or I guess it's just one continuous game broken up into episodes. But, yeah, very, very good game. And then Hotline Miami is very good. You should definitely check that out if you haven't. Very awesome PC game.
Hotline Miami.
Yeah, it has like just some amazing music, and it's kind of like 8-bit looking, and it's like overhead. It almost kind of looks like an old GTA game before
Oh,
GTA 3.
sweet.
And but like the whole game is like you go into like buildings and you just beat the shit out of guys. But like if you get hit once, you're dead, and if you hit them once, they're dead. So like you have to be kind of
Oh,
careful with how you do
interesting.
things. But yeah, you pick up different weapons or bats or guns or just all kinds of stuff, and it's like super violent and 8-bit, and it's kind of a weird little story. It kind of reminds me of like Fight Club or something. But super cool, great music, and I think that game's like $10 or maybe even a little less than that.
That's not bad.
Yeah, and that's a very cool game. What about you, Zach? What about some cheap games lately?
Well, I got Pokemon White 2 for $15 at Best Buy just because it
Oh
was a
yeah.
sale.
Yep.
And like I said last week, still addicted to it.
Yeah.
But cheap, I got the Dead Space iOS game for like 99 cents.
Oh yeah, that's a
And
good deal.
it is a good deal. Unfortunately, it's on my iTouch.
Oh.
So playing it is difficult. I'm going to try and get it on my
Yeah,
wife's
sure.
tablet because maybe I can play it better there. But that was a good
I'm
deal. I
sure,
think I
yeah.
got Jetpack Joyride for free, and God, that game's addicting.
That game is, yeah. I remember I played through the whole thing once, like, unlocking everything.
Yeah, I wish
It's
that
good.
soundtrack was the soundtrack to my life.
Yeah, that's a real good game.
But I can't think of really too many games that I just found that were cheap.
That are just always cheap.
Just
Yeah, that's
always
what I was trying to
cheap.
think of. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Especially, like on a console or a handheld.
Yeah, like I guess I've gotten some virtual console games that were reasonably cheap on
Yeah.
the 3DS. But no, not really. But I'll tell you an expensive full price game that I will always regret buying at full price is God, what was it called? It was Batman Vengeance. It was the old GameCube, PS2, Xbox, Batman animated series game.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And it looked so good in previews. And then the game itself was so mishandled.
There were two Batman games like that, weren't there?
There was another one that was more realistic, yeah. I forget what that one was called, but it was a little, tried to be a little more like what Arkham Asylum was, but I think it got a one in EGM.
Oh, geez. Okay.
I forget what that one was called, but it
Because,
was widely hated.
like, if you're describing the one I'm thinking of, I think I like that one, the Vengeance one. I
No,
think.
it's based on the anime series, and you're fighting the Joker and stuff, but like the controls were a little off, and it was a very incredibly short game, like a 3-hour game.
Oh yeah, I'm
And
looking at it now. I did like the probably the only reason I really liked it is didn't it have like cutscenes that looked like the animated series and stuff?
yes,
It had like really good cutscenes and
that's the
stuff.
part I liked about it. But the cutscenes were always like 20 seconds long.
Right.
And so whenever and one of the funny things is you unlock the cutscenes to watch anytime you want, as you see them. So I spent a lot of time just watching the
Watching
cutscenes.
those, sure.
But the game itself, I don't think I liked very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Tetris Worlds, that's another one that
Yeah.
I don't know, I was in college, I had some money to burn. Well, I like
Was
Tetris.
sure, and it was
This is
just
the
that or
worst
that.
version of Tetris ever made.
Right, it was that or drugs, and you thought, well, I guess we'll just
I know.
try
I'm already
Tetris.
on a bunch of drugs.
Yeah, you're set. You're prescribed. Recently, Resident Evil 6 was a really bad full purchase, but luckily I sold it on eBay for $50 and got
I'm
most of my money
regretting it at
back.
20.
Yeah, right? It's bad.
It's really awful.
I think that's it. For the most part, I'm usually pretty careful about just going out and buying games for full price if I don't know anything about them.
Yeah, me too.
I try to, do a little research or kind of know what I'm getting into ahead of time. Resident Evil 6, I was like, well, the reviews are sort of not great, but I played all of the other ones, right? I should give it a try. It can't be that bad.
Well,
But I
yes, it
really hated
can.
it. Yeah, it was really bad.
I feel sorry for people who bought Colonial Marines full price.
Yeah, for sure. I work with a guy, and he's kind of a weird dude. Like, I wouldn't say we're friends, but you know, we work together, and he always will kind of come up to me and just tell me the most random stuff I should check out, like weird movies he watches on Netflix that I'll never ever watch. But he came up to me one day at work, like last week, and he was like, "Hey man, you gonna check out that Aliens game?" I was like, I don't know. You know, I haven't heard a lot of great things about it." And he's like, "Dude, I picked it up last night. Game is awesome. Unbelievable." And he's like, "Listen, these reasons, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's like he's playing a totally different game. He's like, the game looks great. Like, it looks really good. And I mean, I've watched videos of it, and it doesn't look good. It looks really bad." He's just talking about how great it is. And
he's playing whatever version EGM got.
Yeah, right? 9.0.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of funny.
That is funny.
But, yeah, so I think that's it for that one.
Yeah.
Can't think of another game I paid a lot of money for that I was unhappy with right now. Let me see here. Okay, so we've gone a little while, but let's maybe jump to some of these Twitter conversation starters here and see if there's anything we want to talk about.
Yeah.
Why don't you pick? You've got the list there. Anything you want
to approach? Let's talk about your impressions, our impressions of the PS4.
Sure, yeah. So that was announced last week, middle of the week, on Wednesday, and I was surprised at the length of the conference. First and foremost, you're kind of used to these Nintendo Directs now where it's just like,
15 minutes long.
Right, here's 50 to 20 minutes of stuff, and like, that's it, now we'll talk about some more later. This felt like a full E3 kind of thing. I mean, like, even longer than that.
Like,
you know?
2 hours long.
Right, I mean, this was like, they didn't hold anything back for the most part. I mean, they really did pull out all the stops, and I was very much surprised at that. I think when it started, whoever came out first was like, "And over the next couple of hours, we're going to do this." And I was like, "Couple of hours? Are you serious?" And I watched most of it. I missed kind of the beginning because I was coming home from work or something. But I caught once they started like showing actual game footage and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I think new hardware is always exciting. More so than just, like, a single game announcement. Right. There's just something... I mean, it's the same way, like, getting a new computer or getting a new phone or anything. There's just something kind of fun about getting new hardware.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm excited that it's this year. And, yeah, no, I don't know. None of the game stuff really blew me away, necessarily.
Yeah, me neither.
It's just like, eh, okay.
Franchises I don't care about.
Exactly. Killzone, don't care. Yeah, and nothing... Yeah, what was it? Drive Club or...
Right, Drive Club, and Infamous.
Oh, yeah, Infamous. Yeah, that didn't really do anything for me. Watch Dogs looked really good.
Yeah, Watch Dogs did look cool.
And then apparently that's coming to Wii U, we found out that week, too.
Yeah.
Which I'm interested to see how that looks compared to the version that's on these next-gen consoles.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine it'll be a little bit of a step down, but who knows, maybe it won't be so bad. Or it could be really bad. Like, remember the... Wii version of Dead Rising. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
That was really bad.
It looked like somebody smeared Vaseline on across your TV.
Yeah, you could only have like 10 zombies on the screen at once compared to the original Dead Rising,
right.
Where it's just
like 100
waves
of
zombies.
Yeah, exactly.
That was bad.
That was embarrassing.
But yeah, I don't know. What did you think about it?
I was just kind of underwhelmed. I mean, mainly because I'm irritated that they're pushing streaming so hard and always online, and you just know that stuff's going to be subsidized. I'm sure it'll be wrapped into PlayStation Plus.
Right, so you'll have to pay for all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they somebody said afterwards, like, a reporter asked one of the guys, "So is it going to be required that you have this streaming service to download things where you can, you know, play things as you download them?" He said, "No, it's not required, but we encourage it," which to me means, well, we hope you buy it.
Right, yeah.
So that annoyed me. I'm really more annoyed that PS3 games won't work on it.
No backwards compatibility. That really sucks.
Yeah, and it's because it's a different processor or architecture? I don't know what any of that means.
Yeah, I don't really get that anymore. I mean, I understand back in the day going from console to console, but at this point... I mean, these things are just, I mean, they're computers, right? Yeah. And I understand that it's not like you can play a game that was designed for Windows 95 on Windows 7 right now, at least not easily. But when it's just one generation apart, I don't think there's really any excuse for not the games not being able to run.
No.
I mean, how I know there was the cell process and all that stuff, you know, that kind of made the PS3 difficult to port, you know, from the 360. It was different, but come on. I mean, it's your architecture. Yeah, you should have a way to make them work on each other.
Throw a cell chip in the PS4.
Yeah.
I don't know how any of it works, but, you know, and the other thing that makes me nervous is that, just like the PSP, all of my discs are now worthless. All my disc-based games, because, you know, remember when the PSP went to the Go?
Yeah.
And do you remember there were rumors that maybe you'll be able to, like, send in your UMDs to Sony and they'll give you a voucher.
Right, like you could transfer
code.
Right, like, yeah. Transfer it to digital. Yeah.
Yeah, and that never happened. That's not going to happen here either.
No.
If you want to play Resident Evil 6 on your PS4, you'll have to stream it from Gaikai.
Yeah.
And that's going to suck. That's going to eat up all your download limit, by the way.
Right, if your ISP has some sort of cap on how much you can download.
Yeah,
that's going to be interesting too as we kind of move into this next generation. I mean, with such a push, I mean, not just Sony, but even Nintendo with every game virtually being available for download. I mean, these caps are going to have to get raised or removed altogether, which they won't get removed altogether. So hopefully they get raised, or there's going to be this weird bottleneck that's going to be preventing people from making this next, you know, step technologically. So yeah,
it's like the technology is outpacing the, I don't know, availability of consumer options, I guess.
Right. Well, and options is the right word. It's not like it's outpacing like the infrastructure, because we could just have unlimited downloads and be able to just, you know, stream a download as much as we want. So it's going to be up to these providers to recognize that these caps are going to have to change because demand is changing. So,
and the only other thing I took away from it is that the controller is hideous. Just hideous. Oh,
it's kind of big and bulky now.
Yeah.
I like the sticks are a little more concave.
Yeah, that is nice.
Because I like the sticks better on the 360 controller, and then I like everything else, you know, like button layout and everything on the PS3 controller. So I think that'll be nice. Your thumbs will fit in it comfortably.
Sure. But that big, weird-looking touchpad on the top?
Yeah, that they didn't even really show much of, like, anything using it.
Yeah.
I like that you've got the share button, though, right there on the controller, so at any moment you can just, you know, share images or video of what you're doing.
That is cool. The ability for other people to remotely take over your game, that made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah, right. But yeah, so it's cool. I mean, it's kind of a extension of the Miiverse stuff where you can, you know, post and post screenshots right from what you're doing, except this, it looks like it will be linked to like social networks and stuff. So like it was already linked to what you're doing instead of being its own separate, you know, service.
Yeah.
Not that that's necessarily better. I don't think I'd want all my Miiverse stuff like flooding my Twitter timeline. You know, I don't want all the dorks that I follow to like be tweeting about beating a level in Mario and stuff.
Right.
Like I like to keep that in Miiverse and then just keep my normal nonsense in Twitter. So I'm fine with that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see E3. I really hope they have franchises I give a crap about.
Do you care? Are there any Sony franchises you do give a crap about?
Oh, sure. I mean, if they made a real Ratchet and Clank game.
Okay, sure.
Not one of these, you know, offshoot games. Or if they made a new Uncharted.
Oh, yeah.
Better than Uncharted 3.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. There are Sony franchises I like a lot. I'd say God of War, but there's a God of War right around the corner.
Yeah, I don't really care about God of War, but Uncharted would be good.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting. The graphics do look better.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see the individual fibers on Jake's untucked, not Jake, on Nathan's untucked shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, like dynamic. It'd be sort of like Batman, but even more so. We have like dynamic damage done to his, dynamic damage done to his clothing and everything. Yeah, that would be good. But yeah, the same as you, all the game footage didn't really do anything for me, but I'm just excited about the prospect of new hardware.
It's got a lot of potential.
Yeah, but my PS3 is broken. I was looking forward to this as, you know, a way to replace my PS3, but now it doesn't play anything on the PS3, so I don't know if I should buy a PS3, or I don't know what to do, because I've still got the games.
Turn the thing on? Would you be able to save your save files and stuff?
Nope. It literally powers on for like 1 second, and then the yellow light starts to flash, so it's done. I think to repair it is like 100 or 150, and it's just like, it's so stupid to pay that money when it's like, this is right around the corner, so I don't know. I'll probably just end up selling all my PS3 stuff and just move on to the PS4 and just cut my losses. It's not like there's anything I was dying to finish on the PS3, but I did have some games, but oh well.
You won't be able to finish Resident Evil 6. Oh wait, you sold that.
Sold that quick. Within a few days of buying it. Oh, yeah, wow. Absolutely. Oh yeah. Yeah. I think I had the game over a weekend and then I sold it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was not good.
No.
So yeah, I think that'll do it. We're doing pretty good on time here. We've got a few other topics, but maybe we'll save those for another time.
Yeah, you gotta go ahead and beat Dead Space so we can spoiler it up.
Yeah, I will get to that. I guess I've just been so incredibly busy the past like week, but hopefully this weekend I'll get some time into it.
Just real quick, where are you in the game?
I am, oh god, what happened last? The whiny, awful guy, died.
Okay, good. Yeah, man, that was a great part of the game. So happy about that. You're like...
I'm near the end, right? No, I mean, I've got to be. Oh, am I not?
You're not.
Oh, geez. I thought I was getting there.
You're maybe 2/3.
Oh, okay. That's not bad. Well, I mean, I knew I wasn't right there, but I figured I was... I mean, I think I've almost put 10 hours in. I figured it wasn't terribly longer than that.
Yeah. Good boss fight before that guy bit it. A
couple more hours. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah, that was a good one.
And the plot does kick in the last 2 hours.
Okay, good. I look forward to that, because so far, the plot really hasn't...
Done anything
for me either way, except for this whiny guy who I just absolutely hate. So stupid. So stupid.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just so dumb. I mean, go back to just Dead Space where you're just alone and just walking around and having to do things. I mean, why do we need these auxiliary characters who are just awful?
And they don't do anything.
I mean, it reminds me of like Metroid Prime 3.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have all these, you know, you meet all these characters and you're like, you know, you're working with the whatever, like, I don't know if it's the Federation or what it is, but, you know, you're meeting all these other bounty hunters and stuff. And then it's just like all this extra stuff you don't need in there, man. Yeah. Just drop me on a planet and let me kind of explore. That's all we want.
Don't give me a mission.
Yeah.
Don't make me do your laundry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. Stupid. But yeah, that'll do it. So thanks everyone for writing in. If you have listener mail, you can always send that to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. And we'll talk to you guys later.
Yep. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Today's thrilling episode is brought to you by Nintendo World Report, home of Radio Free Nintendo and other stuff, allegedly. I'm Tyler Olu, and now it's time for another thrilling episode of Connectivity Presents Runner 2, Future Legend of Rhythm Alien Segment.
Beautiful, beautiful. Mm. As you know, Tyler Olu's here. I'm Scott Thompson, and we also have Zach Miller.
Hello!
And we're going to talk about the game we've all, to some degree, I think, obsessively been playing this week.
Yeah.
Kind of came out of nowhere, and yet I find any free time I have, I boot up the Wii U and try to beat a level or two or try to beat a high score, and I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Did either of you play the original Bit Trip Runner?
Oh, yeah.
Nope.
Okay, so you did, Tyler. Yeah. I didn't, and Zach didn't.
What? That's weird. So for you, like you said, oh, this came out of nowhere. I was like, no, I've been really wanting it pretty bad for a while now. I think I think I did some research for something, and it was like came out in like 2010. And I think Neil's I mentioned the same thing where it really stood out to him as like the best of like the Bit Trip series, six games. Yeah, it was just the same sort of thing. It had a more of a minimalistic look, very blocky. Really good stuff though. Great music, and you know, it like took off. Like, I can't speak. I don't think all the Bit Trip games even came out elsewhere, but I know like Bit Trip Runner definitely came out on Steam. They had a tie-in promotion when Portal 2 came out. It was like a. It's been like a pretty big hit. So, Runner 2's been on the top of my list for a while now. I love it.
Yeah, it definitely is probably the most well-known of the Bit Trip games. It just, for some reason, the Bit Trip games, I just missed all of them. I haven't played any Bit Trip games up until now.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Well, you guys should probably both pick up the Bit Trip collection. I think it's like Bit Trip Saga. It was on sale like 2 weeks ago. That's crazy. On 3DS Bit Trip Saga. I paid like full retail for that, like $40, and like it's an awesome deal. And then
on 3DS.
On
right?
3DS, yeah. And then I think it's either the same price or even $30, but it might be less now on Wii, and that's the Bit Trip collection, and that even has online leaderboards for the games and stuff like that. So
that's the big selling point for me would be the online leaderboards.
Yeah. So I can't say like how amazing populated it's not going to be as like well functioning or you know still updating Runner 2 is, but you guys should totally check it out. Like those are good games. Like it's a really good series.
Yeah, and I mean this game makes me kind of want to go back. Just the humor of it and just how well designed it is and really the leaderboards, which I know like you're saying won't be as functional now so many years later.
They'll have something they'll have something to aim for though. Like you'll see scores and be like
high scores, sure.
Yeah.
But does the original have Charles Martinet?
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't have me either. Charles Martinet is the voice of Mario, and I'm you may recognize me as Waluigi. But no, he's not involved with that. That was a really interesting get of Gaijin Games, the developer. That was weird.
I just love it because he's someone who's so entrenched in like in games, but as one specific character. You know, he's not like, you know, Nolan North or something.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he has one voice and he's not doing it here. And I think that's what's so great.
Yeah, it's weird because I think he means something to us. Like, definitely. Yeah. Like, as Nintendo gamers, just because of, obviously, Mario. But to other, I don't know what anyone else even thinks, because it's really weird because he introduces himself by his, like, his name. He's not like, this is Commander Video. He's like, I'm Charles Martinet. Like, so I think it must be lost on, like, a lot of people. But we appreciate it.
Yeah, no, you're probably right, because, yeah, you're just like, well, who's Charles Martinet? Like, what's the point here? But maybe people look it up, and then they see it, and then they're just like, oh, that's amazing. You know, I don't know. Because everyone knows that voice. I mean, who doesn't know Mario's voice?
Yeah.
Everyone does.
Starving children in Africa.
Yeah, I would think so. They've played Mario Kart.
Yeah,
they know.
Who hasn't?
They made Mario Kart 64. So, yeah, let's talk about, just for anyone who maybe hasn't played the game yet, and if you have a Wii U, you should definitely be playing this game. But if you haven't, let's talk a little bit about what you do. You basically avoid obstacles.
You're constantly running forward.
Yeah. Yeah. You have no control of it.
You press different buttons to avoid different obstacles.
Yeah.
Or so combinations of buttons.
Sure. So whether it's jumping over things, sliding under them, pulling up like a shield to block them away, kicking them to get them out of the way.
Nope.
I think that's the major ones there.
Yeah. Yep. There's a loop-de-loops with the right stick. That's very different from the original.
Right.
And I just got to, like, a square-shaped loop-de-loop.
Ooh.
Where you hit the four face buttons at the right time to get bonus points.
Oh nice. Man. That's awesome.
I haven't even gotten to that yet.
No. Yeah, it's really good. And an important part too is like the whole rhythm alien thing, where that comes from, is that it's all tied into the music.
Right.
All the jumps and kicks and the gold blocks that you go for, they all tie into the music, and it's all beats and really cool music, really great stuff.
Yeah, right, you find as you're playing the game, you are like developing a rhythm, and you can almost, whether you're watching, I mean, you're watching the game, but you can almost time your button presses like with the rhythm of the beat, rather than like just waiting for your character to get close enough to have to jump. Yeah. I mean, it gets to a point, especially when you're doing a lot on the hardest difficulty, where you kind of like feel the rhythm of it, and you know what you're going to have to do.
Yeah.
It's really unique. I like that.
Yeah, and it sticks in your head. I still have stuff from Runner 1 in my head. Like, I've been playing that on break at work, like, just, like, trying to prepare for, like, just seeing your Scott and Patrick's crazy scores. Like,
yeah.
And Noah, I think Phil Theobald is on the top of the leaderboards in a lot of games, too. So, you guys make it so tough on me. It's crazy.
Well, I find that that's, like, what I've spent most of my time doing lately. Like, I'm still in the first world. I mean, I haven't really gotten far. Just because well, first of all, when I play a level, I won't beat it unless I at least get all the gold. Like, I don't have to, like, perfectly nail. Yeah, like, I don't have to perfectly nail the loop-de-loops, and I'll even let it go if I don't hit the bullseye at the end. But I have to get all the gold. Like, I won't accept beating a level without all the gold. And you know, now that with the high scores with the leaderboards, which is so great because it shows you before you start a level the leaderboards, so you know where your friends are at. And then at the end of the level, it shows you, you know, like, how you stacked up against them. And I think that's so great because it gives you something right from the get-go to, like, shoot for. You know, it's not like you're playing the game separately and then you go to a different menu or something to see the leaderboards. You're like, oh, okay, right. He did this. I need to go back and do that. It's like, here's this level. Oh, and here's what your friends have already done. So try to beat them.
What I don't understand is how people like Patrick get such insane scores, because I'm playing this level on the hardest difficulty. I'm getting all the gold. I'm getting all the multipliers. I'm dancing my ass off. I hit the bullseye at the end, and he's still like 200,000 points ahead of me. What are you doing, Patrick?
And he is so, like, modest, I guess? Like, just because he's like,
he's
like, you guys should be able to compete quite easily.
I think he's being facetious. I think he has this ultra strategy, and he's just trying to throw us off the trail. He's like, oh, I'm just playing how I play. I mean, you guys should be able to beat me. I'm not doing anything special. And, you know, he was like on Twitter, he's like, I think maybe if you rotate the right stick a lot, maybe you'll get more points. I think that's bullshit. He's trying to get us off the trail. Fuck you, Patrick.
This is his new pinball game.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, Patrick is amazing. If you haven't added us to your Nintendo friends list yet and you're playing Runner 2, now is a very good time. I think I have like 4 open spots. So first come, first serve there. Unless I know you, then I'll bump off someone I don't know. Sorry if I bump you off. but yeah, I'm okay. So what about you guys? Why don't you share those IDs now?
Albert.
Yep.
And I'm Tyler Olu. I like to keep it simple. Tyler and O-H-L-E-W.
Oh, yeah, okay, so yeah, your full name.
You just go to the site. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, right. You can find them there. But the competing for high scores is definitely, I think, the best part.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm surprised at how complex the levels do become. You know, it starts off fairly simple, and especially once you switch to the harder difficulty, I mean, you're in constant motion, and I love once you've kind of got your full repertoire of moves, I mean, how you're just going between them, so it's like jump, duck, block, kick, jump, duck, you know, and then it's just, and then how it strings them together sometimes.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of fun. And you really do, like, I find myself kind of bobbing my head, like, with the music and with beat of, like, pressing the buttons, like, when I really get into the zone.
I like how if you go from the easiest difficulty to the hardest, it's kind of like a different level at the end.
Yeah, just because of all the extra stuff. Okay, well, so
even the layout changes sometimes.
The actual level layout changes?
I think it does a little bit.
I thought they just threw in more enemies and stuff, like more stuff you had to dodge and jump over and all that
stuff. Well, that could be it. Maybe I'm just paying attention to the layout more when it's hard.
When there's a bunch of stuff you have to dodge. Yeah. I think, Tyler, does that sound right? I mean, have you messed around with the
difficulty? Yeah, I've been fooling around. I've never gone down. I've just gone up because I didn't even think about that going up would raise your score. I was like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense.
Right.
So I have been playing on the hardest just to see, just because Runner, like, I, you know, got through that. So I figure, like, I should be okay.
Sure.
And I'm doing all right. But anyways, I'm not anywhere close to anywhere near the leaderboards. But yeah, it's just definitely more enemies and stuff like that. Just you need to have much, much quicker reactions.
And does he run a little faster?
That I can't say. I don't know. Like, because I've been sticking on hard for so long, I only did like the first few stages. Now I'm just doing that. So
right.
I could see that complicating things, but Jesus, that'd be crazy. Because the enemy, just more enemies is enough. Like,
right.
You feel the difference right away. Like,
because I feel like in the first few levels, and maybe it's just because the levels have gotten more difficult, but there's parts where there's like stairs basically, and you have to like jump up them. You know, it's a common level structure. It was like 3 platforms you had to jump up. And in the earlier stages, I felt like I had a pretty good amount of time to just like 1, 2, 3 jump up them. And now, you know, maybe they've just been shortened because it's a further on level. But now it feels like I have to, like, as soon as like I touch the ground, I have to jump again. Like, there's no time to jump, land, run for like a split second, and then jump. It's like you got to hit it exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I thought maybe the speed had been increased. But I haven't experimented and gone back and like lowered the difficulty to see.
Yeah. It's hardly an excuse, but I do find like because of the give of the buttons, I almost like second guess myself. Like I'm like, am I pushing the button really hard fast enough? I feel like the Wii U gamepad buttons have a lot more give. And just from playing on the 3DS where it's like just feels like a pure digital click, like just very, very, you can really quickly press it. I'm really concerned for later on, like for needing to press things really rapidly, but see when we get there.
I know, I get that feeling too. And in fact, like I kind of have the problem where it's like a big gap I have to jump over, and I feel like I'm pressing the button like long enough that I should make it, you know, because you kind of float in the air for a little bit when you hold the button.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I'll find that like I'm just a little bit short, and I'll hit the platform and, you know, and then start over.
There's so much stuff about it that I'm like, oh, that's so smart. Like with the checkpoint, the game almost like I feel like the camera like pulls out a bit, and you can see that it's coming up ahead, and then it almost slows down even. Yeah, gives you a chance to jump over it.
Which
and
is
believe
so
it or
great.
Not, I've still messed it up sometimes and like totally ran into it, and I'm like, oh, what am I doing? This is terrible.
That's so smart. Like I really love that because on one hand you have this checkpoint here, so not only can you adjust the difficulty, but you can play on easy and then also have this checkpoint, which will start you from the middle of the stage if you die later on. Okay, so that's great, but they use it like nefariously when you're trying to compete for high scores, because you jump over the checkpoint and you get bonus points for doing that. So you don't hit the checkpoint. If you die, you start over. But you get those bonus points, which you have to get if you're going to get, you know, crack the leaderboards. You're not going to beat anyone if you get the checkpoint. So they do, they kind of sometimes strategically place it where it's like, it is an obstacle. Like, yeah, you jump for the gold, land, and have to jump immediately to clear the checkpoint. I think that's so cool to have this checkpoint that plays these two distinct roles, like good and bad.
Yeah. You won't find the checkpoint in, Runner One. It's definitely not in there. And, the levels can get really, really long, and it's like, and I just, as I imagine they will in Runner Two, and it gets crazy.
Have you played any retro stages yet, Tyler?
In Runner Two?
Yeah.
No, I haven't, no. Yeah. I hear talk of this stuff, and I'm really, I'm like, oh, there's all this weird stuff. And I feel like, I don't know if it's necessarily a fault of the game, but I do, I guess they just want to maybe, I don't know, like, add to that weird, like, NES mystery of, like, you being like, what does this do? Like, where, like, there's a picture of, like, a key, and it's treasure chest, and it's like, you didn't get it, and I'm like, but how do I get it? I don't even know what. It's really, really weird, yeah. But that's cool, too. It gives you something to, like, to kind of keep an eye out for and try to figure it
out.
I think I got to a level that, like, says, like, all the keys are now visible in all the levels, so I got to go back or something. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Totally.
It's funny, too, like, the Super Meat Boy, it's not just that he's in the game, like you see him in the opening cinematic, and perhaps he's another playable character or something. But when they're developing Runner One, I think they said it must have been concurrent with Super Meat Boy, because Edmund McMillan, like the programmer and like the, well, I think he's mostly the artist behind Super Meat Boy, but he suggested to Gaijin Games to do the instant go back to the beginning thing, like of when you fail.
Rather
I guess
like,
originally it was
rather
more
than
like a
fade to black or start the level.
Yeah,
over
exactly. Which, like, even in like Mario, like it still takes some time. Like when you do like Coin Rush, and you're kind of like, oh, this is like, of course I want to restart, or like, why does it have to be like? Maybe it can restart, and then I can make my decision if I want to quit. Like, don't give me that option every single time. It's annoying. So it would have been like a super different game if Edwin Gamelin would have given that little piece of advice. So. It's
like a really brilliant decision, because it does feed into that just like, okay, one more time. I'll try one more time. You know, if it dropped you back to the level menu, it'd be so easy to just turn the game off.
I even feel like I wish it would just restart at the beginning.
Well, that's true. So as great as we think this game is, there have been a lot of like weird sort of technical problems that they're apparently going to address with a future patch. Now whether that's when you start the game, it asks you if you want to be connected online so you can enjoy all the leaderboards and stuff. And then there's a, you know, a yes or no option. And when you select something, it sort of pauses for like 10 seconds and you're not really, it doesn't say loading. It doesn't really tell you what's going on. So you're kind of like, did it work?
I think there's no audio, correct? Or no audio at all? Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah. And so, yeah, that totally faked me out the first time. I was like, okay, is it not working? And then it finally just went.
I started tapping it on the touchscreen. I was like, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do.
I did that too. I pressed A, I tapped the screen, I pressed start. Yeah, it was just nothing. And then there's a weird quirk with the leaderboards where your high score doesn't remains. Like, if you play a stage and you get a score, then that's your high score. And then if you play that level again, even if you get a lower score, it replaces your high score, like, with whatever your most recent score is, which is just wrong. So, like, I think that happened to me because, like, I played a bunch of the game the first day while Tabby was at work, and then she came home and I was like, check this game out. And so I just put her back on the first level, but, you know, playing as my, you know, as my record or whatever.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So she played, like, three or four levels, and, you know, she beat them, but she didn't, like, get all the gold and stuff. And then I went back and looked, and I was like, oh, my God, you were embarrassing me.
Yeah. That's awesome. You're like, huh? Oh my God, I'm the top of the world. I'm the best person in the world. And it's like, boom, tank. It's like she ran into the first Goomba. And you're like,
right.
Oh,
yeah, exactly. And then it, like, everyone in the world knew that first Goomba killed me or something.
Yeah. But like you guys said, forgive me if I'm saying his last name wrong, but Alex Newsy, of Gaijin Games, he announced today that they're addressing all those issues. And there's another one where people are finding that if they hit the home button to quit the game or even just turn off the console while they're playing the game, that the system will, like, hard lock. But they're working on that, but they said that that doesn't happen on dev kits, that that's only been something that's happening on retail units.
Which is so weird.
That might be a harder thing to work around. I'm not too sure. Yeah.
I haven't had that problem, although
I haven't had any of these problems.
Yeah. Well, but, I've had the, you know, obviously where the screen, where it takes a while to load after
that's true.
You want to be online. But other than that, people, you know, I've talked to people on Twitter, like, when, because I've talked about Hulu hard locking a lot, and I didn't try it, but they said, one guy said he downloaded Zombie U, I think it is, and he was having a hard lock a lot, and then he completely deleted it, and then re-downloaded it, and it was totally fine after that. Yeah, give that a shot, and see. I'd imagine, I don't know what'll happen to all your high scores. I mean, I'm sure you can keep your save data, just delete the actual game file.
One thing I'd really like to see is something that, Criterion does in, like, their like Need for Speed games and Burnout and stuff is not necessarily, like, of course show, like, the leaderboard, who's the top leaderboard and stuff like that, but show who of your friends is closest among you and try to get that score instead of being like, oh good, Scott has like 2 billion points, I'm scratching just over 100,000, like, what am I doing wrong? Just show me, like, who has 100,002 points and I can beat their score. I think that just promotes you know, beating it to try to achieve something instead of just being like, this is impossible.
Right. It keeps it, like, on a, like, on a small scale.
Yeah.
Which would
be really
good.
Cool.
I imagine that's not as much a problem for people who don't have a ton of friends in their friends list. Like, we've talked about this before. And Tyler, how many friends do you have on your friends list?
I have like 70. I accept like every request.
Yeah.
And then I get like, you go to your activity feed and I'm like, oh good. A friend of mine drew a line and posted it to Miiverse. That's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it's kind of like how Swapnote, like, I think Swapnote works great if you have like 5 3DS friends, but when we add everyone, like, through Nintendo World Report, like listeners and readers and stuff like that, you know, it just becomes too much.
But I find when I went to the actual leaderboards, like, it's not even like, I don't know, I didn't feel like it was crazy long, like, not as many people own it. I guess when you start dealing with so many, like 70 or so many people, I feel like I have like less than 20 or something like that. Maybe I just have, I'm friends with all the wrong people. No, that's
yeah,
not nice.
Probably. But, well, yeah, the Miiverse, I opened, like, Miiverse the other day while I was playing BitTrip, and the community is only, like, 3,000 people.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of people haven't necessarily, you know, downloaded it and started playing it yet.
Yeah.
But they should, because it's amazing. And, like, there's so little to do on the Wii U right now. And what I love is it's probably one of the few games where I strictly play it on the gamepad. So earlier before we started recording, I sent out a tweet asking for people to, send me, their 140 character thoughts about the game. So alarmingly, I didn't get very many, like, comments about the actual game. So, Lord MBZ, who's a listener to the show, said, wish I could comment on it, but it isn't out in the European Wii U eShop yet. Oh. Sad face. And then shortly after, Nicholas Bray, who lives in Australia and is a staff writer, said, who knows? It's not out yet. Tongue out face. So yeah, so they're kind of mad. our own Zach Kaplan isn't interested. He said he'd rather talk about Steel Diver 2, which isn't a thing and will never be a thing. Third Rate Minion said Runner 2 lets you make friends with a pickle who you can dress like a farmer. That's true innovation. But seriously, good stuff. I agree. It is good stuff. Our own JP Corbin said I would be playing the shit out of Runner 2 if it weren't if I weren't completely addicted to FIFA 13 right now, which is just crazy.
Oh, and like weird puzzle 3DS games, Nikolai games or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to always tease him about JP.
Yeah, I think so. And then Disco Stu said, Runner 2 is perfectly designed to give me pleasure, which I thought was kind of weird in a sexual way, but yeah. I agree with him in whatever way he
needs. Maybe Runner 2 needs those like weird like biofeedback things that Rez had. Like you can hook up other like Wii U pro controllers and have them like vibrate on your butt or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. That would be good.
Yeah,
I'd want my butt vibrated while playing Runner 2.
I'm almost surprised just because of like how like weird the game can get. Like and just like, you know, like they have Meat Boy in there. Like they obviously love video games in general. So that'd be a really cool reference, I guess.
Yeah, that actually would be kind of funny. Or even if it was just one of the commercials.
That's what they were called, trans vibrators.
They were, yeah. Or even if it was just like fake, like one of the commercials that opens the game, you know, each time.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be good. And then both Austin Clark and then friend of the show TR Brody both mentioned the fact that it just hard locks all the time when you try to quit. So
I went on a little Twitter rant last night. I got my condescending sarcasm in on that issue.
Really? You were not happy, huh?
No.
So that's Runner 2. I don't really know what else we could say. We could probably force ourselves to keep talking about it because I think there's just a lot of great little tiny things that make it so much fun.
Honestly, I'd rather just go play it.
Yeah, me too.
And try and beat Patrick.
Yeah, well, that's always the challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know. There's nothing really else to say. If you haven't downloaded this game yet, you should do it.
Yeah,
it's $15, which is maybe a little high for some people, for a game where you ostensibly just, you know, dodge things. Because I mean, it feels like a really, really, really like well designed iPhone game, but like, you know, brought to a console. But really, I mean, this could be an iPhone game where you just tap the screen to like. Jump over something or
I can't imagine tapping the screen.
Oh, no, me neither. You do way
just
too
for
much
like
stuff
how nuts it gets. And
right,
ducking.
Right, right. Without as much, but like if all you had to do was like jump or ducks, like you swipe up to jump, swipe down to duck, and then that was a whole game, right? Like that could be an iPhone game.
Yeah.
And
I think there's so much.
Yeah, right. But there's so much like charm here and production value, and there's just I don't know. There's something about this game. It really is charming.
I think what really makes it stand out with this, like, endless runner genre is that these are levels that are, like, very, very well put together. And a lot of their endless runners are just that. They're endless. Like, they just, like, they just make them – what's the word? When they make themselves. Like, they randomly generated. Like, it just, you know, constantly goes. But these are, like, structured levels.
Joyride-y.
Yeah. And they just, you know, the music and it plays such a big role. And I got to say, too, like, the visuals, like, initially I didn't like the design, but now I'm just, like, totally won over. Like, the game's gorgeous. It has a really great art style, very cohesive. It looks different than Runner 1, which is very, like I said, it's very retro and blocky. But I found that sometimes it was hard to distinguish elements of the background that were just the background and not part of, like, you know, something to jump over.
Right.
Because everything was just square. Like, it was almost hard to tell something. Sometimes, and this is definitely a change, and it looks stunning. Yeah,
I had that problem when you play the retro levels because it's all new environments. Yeah. So you do kind of have to like learn what has to be jumped over, what is it that you can kick, what is it you have to like block.
And Runner 1, they were like really Atari based. What's the theme with these retro levels?
Oh, totally Atari based.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, I'd that too. So. Like in Runner 1, it was like the bottom of the screen had the weird like Gaijin Games logo in place of like. What was it? I guess was it Activision that did Pitfall? Like, like how it had like a weird stationery, like it said Activision on Pitfall. Like it looked very much like old Atari game. It was weird.
Yeah, this has a like a you have three hearts and you have a score that keeps ticking up and
This is probably more like NES or Famicom.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
it's
yeah.
more 8-bit because like there's backgrounds and stuff. Like it's not just like, I don't know. It's definitely more detailed.
I imagine
than, like,
so just
because
the Famicom cartridges, I guess that would make sense.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Okay.
And so Tyler, Zach, thanks for being here.
Oh yeah. No problem.
But so that'll do it. Yep. Go play Runner 2, add us to your friends list and try to beat Patrick's high scores. You won't, but give it a try.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Don't forget to send your listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com, and please rate and review the show on iTunes. Now stay tuned for our bonus segment, an Outer Space Q&A with Scott Thompson and Johnny Metz.
Another bonus segment of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson, and today I'm with Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Hello.
And we're doing space segment number two. It's been quite some time, actually. You know, we were talking about how my daughter's in the background right here as we're recording this one, and she was in the background last time, but that time, she couldn't even really probably support her head. I think we had her like in a in some sort of little like rock and play kind of bed thing as she was in the background last time. So it's been, I don't know, maybe 8 or 7 months since the last one.
We've been meaning to do it and just never got around to it. So
exactly.
That's a good time to get back into it. There's a lot of stuff going on that people have probably heard about. We've got like meteorites exploding in the air and asteroids making near miss flybys of the Earth. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Dennis Tito announcing he's going to send someone flyby around Mars in like 5 years from now. No, he's not.
Not happening, huh?
You're calling it. He is going to try, probably.
We've got a bunch of questions from Twitter and the NWR forums and everything. So we're going to keep this to about a half hour. So we'll just kind of go down the list and hopefully get to as many as we can here.
Yeah, I'm going to try to be more concise than I was last time so we can get more questions read. I apologize. Some people have been waiting over 6 months for their questions to be answered, so I feel really bad about that. By the way, I do want to repeat the disclaimer from last time that these are my personal opinions. They don't represent my employer. They're not political statements, yada, yada, yada. This is for information and entertainment only.
All right. Well, yeah, let's get started then. I'll just kind of go down the list here, I suppose. So this one's from user Super. He says, do you think the Reds may have attempted to put a man in space before Yuri, Gagarin, and never made it public when it didn't turn out so well? Know any cool history along the Russian side of things?
Well, it's telling that Ty calls them the Reds. I think the preferred term these days is Russians, but they were the Reds back then. Yes, they were the Soviet Union. I think there's a fair possibility that the Russians tried sending humans in space before Yuri and failed. But we've found out a lot in the past 15, 20 years since the Soviet Union broke up. They've been slowly becoming a little more open with their, at least with their history in the space program. And we've learned a lot more about some of their failures early on, some of the programs that they were pretty deep into and never finished, you know, some of their moon missions. They were trying to send astronauts to the moon or cosmonauts, and they were, you know, building a space shuttle that never flew with people on it. It flew unmanned. It looked a lot like our space shuttle because it was probably based on stolen blueprints of our space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
So they were into a lot of pretty crazy projects that we never heard about because we only ever found out about the successful ones. You know, they were under lock and key. But one thing we learned about is that, I mean, it was a pretty well-known story even back in the 60s and 70s that before Yuri Gagarin, who was the first human in space, back in 61, I'm really bad with dates. Sorry. He was the first human in space. Before that, they had been sending dogs, and the first dog in space, the first mammal that we know of, I think the very first life forms were worms. I want to say they were earthworms. Mm-hmm. And they were thinking that because they were invertebrate, they weren't worried about them breaking bones on the way back or even during, I don't think they brought them back, but during launch, you know, and so they had a higher degree of confidence that they would survive. But Laika was the first mammal. She was a dog. She was a mutt. And, there's statues of her in Russia now. She's a very popular character in Russian culture, even in Western culture. She's somewhat well known, as being the first mammal in space. And the myth was that the Soviet Union perpetuated back in the 60s is that Laika, flew up into space and then survived for like 2 weeks or something like that. And then like died a very peaceful death. due to basically died of thirst, which is supposedly like a very peaceful way to go. Okay. And so she was celebrated as this hero. Well, it turns out we found out, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago after the fall of the Soviet Union, that Laika actually died like maybe a couple hours after launch. She did make it to space and she was living up there, but then they had a problem with the life support and all the oxygen was lost. And so she suffocated.
Oh God.
Yeah. It's pretty horrible. And, you know, and, so it you know, not a very nice way to go probably, but so they lied about that stuff. And that leads me to think, yes, they probably have lied about other things. Now, I don't know that they ever lost a person in space, you know, during a launch. Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible. I think it's definitely possible just based on their history of, you know, they were very controlling of the information that got out there back then and they were in competition. So that's why.
Absolutely. I know it's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, thinking about living today or even, you know, during the space race in the 60s, it's hard to imagine America launching, you know, something into space with humans and no one knowing about it. But like you're saying, in Russia, I mean, information was very, very much controlled. So it's not as hard to believe that could have happened.
And especially, you know, in America, we usually launch space launches out of Cape Canaveral in Florida, which is a very densely populated area. I mean, you could see the space shuttle launching from Disney World, you know. Right. The Soviets launched from Kazakhstan, which is like really the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is okay. Where Borat was from. So
right.
It's very rural, and they also land the Soyuz spacecraft, they land in Kazakhstan on land. And one of the biggest problems they have with landing that way, so Ty asked about any cool history on the Russian side of things. I do know that not a lot of people know this outside the space program, but the Soyuz vehicle has a gun on board, and it's this weird modular gun. It has three different tips. One is basically like a high-powered pistol, and that's used in case of wolves or bears. because Soyuz lands on land, and if it veers off course and it takes several hours for the rescue crew to come get you out, you might have to get out of the capsule and fend for yourself until they come. So the other, barrel that you can attach to it is a flare gun, so you can use that to help the rescuers find you. And the other is a tranquilizer dart, and that's used in case people come up to you and try to attack you or steal stuff. And actually a fair amount of the equipment and just metal that comes down on a Soyuz is scavenged by the local people. And a lot of times they get there before the actual Russian space program people do. And usually they don't cause a problem. They go check it out. They kind of stake it out. And then once they have the cosmonauts out of there and all the officials leave, they go there and they start pulling it apart and they go and they sell that stuff. And it's, you know, there's platinum and copper and titanium. And I mean, it's valuable material. Sure. And a lot of them, you know, they make their living selling like scavenged parts. Or sometimes they just use them to build huts and, you know, kind of like home projects. That's pretty crazy stuff, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And if you fly on the Soyuz, you go to this training program in Star City outside of Moscow, and they teach you to use that gun because it's a unique, like, you know, one of a kind gun that's made only for Soyuz because it has these different barrels you can screw into it.
Right.
It's part of their survival training.
That's amazing. I mean, from the gun to the scavenging, I'm just getting like images of Fallout right now in my head. Like, I don't know why. That's amazing.
Pretty crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stalker might be the better comparison.
Oh, yeah.
Set in post-nuclear Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a good game. Kind of hard to get into, but once you get into the rhythm of it, very good game. All right, but this is a gaming podcast. We're not here to talk about games. We're here to talk about space.
That's right.
So let's move on to the next question from user Bustin98, which I just hope is a Ghostbusters reference in some way.
I think it is.
I hope so. He says, have we looked into long-term time desynchronization of extended space flights and possible ways to overcome the difference in time frames? Most of this doesn't make any sense to me, so hopefully you can explain what he's asking right now.
This is terminology that I don't usually work with, but I think Bustin is talking about cryogenic storage of people, you know, like in Alien.
Right, like hypersleep or something.
Yeah. In 2001, they do it as well.
Yeah.
It's a popular idea because it gets around some of the major logical fallacies of sending people on extremely long space flights, but I don't believe there's any real credible science behind it. There are some, I've heard the story. This is not very scientific, sorry, but I've heard that there are certain kinds of frogs that you can actually freeze for years at a time, and when they thaw out, they come back and they behave as normal. But, you know, the physiology between a frog and a human is so very different. You know,
sure.
They're cold-blooded and they, you know, they breathe through their skin. So I just don't know that there's any kind of transference that we'll ever pull off. I mean, there is some company, I think, that, you know, that claims that after you die, they will come and freeze your body and preserve it until someday in the future when they can, you know, bring you back and save you from whatever killed you. And I think there is a company that actually does that. It sounds very unethical and, you know, scam artist to me. But
yeah,
I don't think what they do is based on very much actual science. I think it's more just kind of preying on people's hopes and fears. So,
you know, to kind of follow up with that, are there sort of tropes in sci-fi books and TV and movies that aren't backed by science at all, similar to this? Because I assume that maybe theoretically this was possible, but you're saying there's really no basis for this. So is that common, I mean, with other sci-fi tropes?
I think theoretically it is possible, you know, but I think the complexities of actually keeping you alive, because they're basically, what they're trying to do is sort of freeze you in time.
Okay.
And that's probably not possible. I mean, they would probably have to keep parts of your brain active and parts of your body active, or else the tissue deteriorates, and just making you cold isn't going to do it. It's way more complicated than that. So
sure.
I'm not saying it's impossible. I just don't think we've really made a whole lot of progress towards that. I don't know that anyone's really even trying, you know, any kind of serious, credible effort in that space. But yeah, there's a lot. I mean, anytime you see like in a TV show or a movie, these small spaceships kind of flying around, and they're doing, if you'll notice, like, and TIE fighters are really bad about this too, even in Star Wars, but the spaceships a lot of times will make maneuvers that are based on aircraft.
Sure.
But aircraft make those maneuvers because they're cutting through air and they're, you know, using jet engines or propellers and none of that stuff. I mean, spaceships just don't move like that, you know? If you've ever seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, that's by far the most accurate movie in terms of how things really move in space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a really believable portrayal of artificial gravity, which we might get a chance to talk about later if we get through enough questions. But
right.
I would always reference people to 2001 because it was very thoroughly researched, and the filmmakers, especially Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, who was involved with the story, were very, very interested in making it real. And they had NASA on board in a pretty big way, really, as consultants to try to make sure that it was realistic and authentic. And I mean, it's set, you know, the stuff they do is even way, way, way beyond what we could do in 2001. So, I mean, it's futuristic, but it's grounded in actual physics. And if you look at the way the things move, through space in that movie, that is a lot more realistic than what you see in Battlestar Galactica, you know, or anything like
right,
that.
Right, where ships are like cutting and
banking,
doing all kinds of flips.
There is no banking in space.
Right.
You know,
that's interesting.
It doesn't work that way. There's no drag to slow you down, so you can't power slide in space.
Right. So the idea of like a space fighter jet is I mean, just not going to happen.
I mean, you could build a small spacecraft and make it really maneuverable, but it wouldn't look like that. It would look like it has a whole bunch of jets coming out all over the place.
Sure.
You know, basically,
so it could
like
move in every direction. Yeah.
Constantly correct your attitude and then push you in the right direction. So
sure.
It's not, but that doesn't look nearly as sexy. So
no, not at all.
Yeah.
All right, let's move. You know, let's go ahead and jump down since you mentioned the artificial gravity. Let's jump to that now.
Popular topic.
I'll break rank here a little bit. So we've got two questions that are sort of tied together. So T. Brody, which from Twitter, who I learned last week, his last name is Brody, not his first name. Why isn't there more effort to do rotating craft for long-haul manned trips? Everyone always bitches about low G, but accepts it. And then Rob Ford also said, Bill Nye says Mars travel is a go if the ship is big enough and spinning fast enough for artificial gravity. Besides cost, what are the other limiting factors?
All right. I feel like we might have talked about this a little bit last time. So
we did. I want to say maybe Danny Vivens asked the question about artificial gravity.
I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time on artificial gravity because it's something that is a little bit far-flung probably. We're not doing a whole lot of work on it right now. There is a really respected researcher up at MIT named Larry Young. I might have mentioned him last time. And he has a lab at MIT with a big centrifuge where you lie on your back. And it's in this room where the whole thing looks like it shouldn't even fit in that room. And I'm sure it's terrifying when they turn it on because it will like almost scrape the walls. They've made it as big as possible to fit in this room, and there's this giant piston in the floor sticking up, you know, this that's on ball bearings, and it just spins really, really fast. And, you know, and they measure the way that the blood in your body gets pushed around as you lay on this thing and gets spun around, and how fast you have to go, and how much gravity can you simulate. Which is really just centrifugal force, you know. It's not actually gravity, but the question is, can you trick your body into thinking that it's gravity? You know, if you do this, will your muscles react more like as if you were actually in gravity? And would your brain react the same way? Well, in a lot of ways it does, but there's also the rotation, which you don't have in a normal gravity field. And the rotation, we do, you know, even on Earth, we're standing on the outside of Earth and Earth is spinning.
It's rotating, sure.
That's not what causes the gravity, but there is this rotation. It's just that the angular momentum that we have out here is so small that we can't, I mean, we've evolved so that we can't detect it, so it doesn't bother us. It is detectable, but our bodies are built so that it's subliminal. And the problem is that if you rotate someone faster than that, you notice it. And then the question is, does that cause so many bad side effects that it overcomes the utility of creating this artificial gravity? So if you're in this thing to keep your muscles and your bones from deteriorating in microgravity over long periods of time, but it makes you throw up constantly, then it's probably a net loss. It's right. Probably not something you want to do. And so they're not really sure about this. There's also, when you test these things on the ground, you also have gravity. And so it creates this weird kind of like, perpendicular force on your body. And so it's difficult to take that out of the results when you look at it. And so what we really need to do is put this stuff in space and test it there. And then you can start to get really good data on how well does this actually work and is it worth pursuing? Can we make advancements on it? And there has been for a few years, there's been a really strong push to get one of Larry's centrifuges up on the space station.
The space station. I was just going to say, ask that, yeah.
They've been trying. I don't know how much progress has been made on that. I don't know if it'll ever really happen, but I hope it does because I think it's a really important research and there aren't too many people working on that stuff. But there's a lot of safety issues with putting a giant spinning heavy thing on the space station. It's, you know, and the space station itself is very sensitive to perturbances. So even, you know, when you have like astronauts outside on a spacewalk and they're screwing in bolts, okay, just the force of you pulling on that tool can actually cause the space station to start spinning the opposite way.
I was, yeah, because, well, because there's nothing holding it there.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, there's just, nothing to hold the station. Float, so it'll just spin. Yeah. It's like Newton's third law. You know, every force, there's an opposite force in the other direction. And so they build tools to minimize that. But then also they have these big gyroscopes. They're called the CMGs, the control moment gyroscopes. And I think there's six of them on the space station. Cause you need at least three. I think you need at least two or three to maintain a certain level of control. And they fail all the time. They replace them all the time. Mm-hmm. But they're these big spinning discs and they can be turned in different directions and they take a lot of power to keep these things spinning cause they're heavy. But they use those to basically balance out all those rotations and try to keep it facing the right way. And they have to keep the station facing the right way so that it picks up the sun's, you know, so all the solar panels are facing the sun and all the radiator panels are facing cold space so they can get rid of heat. So it's a really complicated problem, and putting a big centrifuge up on the station, you know, you have to probably what they're telling him, I would guess that what the ISS program is telling him is that you can put this thing up here, but you also have to send up all of the equipment that's going to balance out the forces that it's going to put on the station. And that then makes it really big and expensive and heavy. So
for something like that, would they build the whole thing on Earth and send it up, or would they, I mean, I assume, right?
Well, you have to build it on Earth, but yeah. And this would go inside the station. So, so it would be basically a piece of exercise equipment, really crazy exercise equipment.
Yeah, really, so crazy, yeah. Huge, massive piece of exercise equipment. Right. Yeah.
And it has to be compatible with all kinds of biosensors and stuff, because the whole point is to collect the data and see how it affects your body. How much of the day do you need to spend in that thing? I mean, these questions from Rob and T. Brody are probably more in the line of spinning the entire vehicle. That's what you see more in 2001.
Right.
Which is that basically the whole vehicle. So then you don't have to worry about, well, you know, if I only do it 2 hours a day, is that enough? You know, but then you have other problems of how are you going to start it spinning, and then how are you going to stop it spinning once you get there? Because that's hard to do. How do you keep it spinning the same speed the whole time, even though you've got things moving on it and disturbing it all over the place?
Well, because you'd think once you adjust to one speed, I mean, yeah, if it moved at all, you would feel like you're saying on Earth, you know, if Earth sped up all of a sudden, we would know it. It would be shocking to us.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, you can use a rocket to start it spinning, but once you do that, it's going to be at some angular momentum. And then as the people inside move around and push things around and do all this other stuff, or if you put any other forces on it, even like solar winds and radiation and stuff like that, will just put these very minor disturbances in it, and it will change that speed of rotation. So over time, you might have to do it again to correct it, or it might speed up. It might spin too fast, and then you have to – it's very, very complicated. And we've never put people in space for long enough that it was necessary. So we've never designed a vehicle that could actually do that safely. One day, maybe. Probably not for Mars. It's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem for going to Mars is radiation, not gravity. So, you know, we could spend a lot of money trying to fix the gravity problem, but the truth is you could probably survive not having gravity all the way to Mars. Especially if you're going to land, because Mars does have gravity. It has about a third of Earth's gravity. So you could go down there, do all your exercises and all the work and all the research and everything else you want to do, and try to get your body back in shape a little bit before you come home and go through it all again. So gravity, it would suck, and you'd be in a wheelchair for a long time after you got back, and, you know, it would be a very long rehab session, but you could probably survive the gravity effects. The radiation's a bigger problem, much bigger.
Sure.
So we have to fix that first.
Yeah. Huh. Pretty wild. All right. Let's keep going here. We've got probably enough time to go through a couple more questions. So let's maybe do a little kind of a fun one here. Donald/Shaman. Shaman. Thank you. I was blanking on it for a second there. Asks, how are people able to tweet from space?
They have satellite internet.
Yep, that was what I was thinking. can they like watch TV and stuff, like in the space station or anything?
They can get YouTube and stuff like that. They don't get. I don't think they have like satellite TV. I don't think they have the equipment to do that, and they have so little free time that
right.
It was not really worth the effort to try to get that stuff up there.
Right.
But they wanted internet mainly for research purposes, because you could send data back down while the mission is going on. So that's very, very valuable. as they're doing like long-term scientific studies up there. But they do have internet access, and it's probably slow. I mean, I don't know if you've ever used satellite internet on the ground, but it's like maybe two or three times faster than dial-up. So right. It's not really what I would consider broadband. It's not very fast, but it works. And the satellites that provide that stuff are in higher orbits than the ISS. So you can still use it. You know, you have to kind of point at the satellites in a little bit different way. It's a lot sharper angle than it would be from the ground, but they basically work the same way. Mm-hmm. And the station does have its own antennas that point directly to tracking stations on the ground. They're like K-band antennas and stuff like that. But I think those are reserved for voice communications and, you know, life support data and stuff like stuff that they need to monitor all the time. And so they can't like give that up just for casual internet usage.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, basically they take up laptops and they use them the same way that you would anywhere else. They just have to be sort of, you know, the laptops are like mounted on kind of a desk thing that juts out from the wall. And then when you use it, you kind of have to hook your feet into some straps on the floor to hold you in as you type. Otherwise the typing would launch you towards the ceiling. It would.
That makes sense. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. The simplest thing.
But it's the actual internet. I mean, it works the same way. You know, they just don't have much time and they don't have a whole lot of bandwidth. But the good thing about tweeting is that it doesn't use much bandwidth. So it's a pretty popular activity.
Right. It's fine for just sending text and stuff. Yeah, that's not an issue.
Yeah. And they like to send photos too. Photography is like probably the number one most popular hobby up on the space station because they have these great windows, you know, and these unbelievable views of the Earth. And it's always there. And so a lot of times, just any kind of free time that they get, they go over and just kind of stare out the window and take photos. So like now they can, with Twitter, they can send those down and, it's become very popular. A lot of people follow those.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm imagining like someone sneaking on like a uTorrent client and trying to download like the latest Game of Thrones or something for like 3 days straight.
No, for that, they do send DVDs up for when they're exercising.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
They have movies. Cause they have to spend 2 or 3 hours a day exercising, or they're supposed to at least. So they run on treadmills and they do, you know, various other, kind of exercise. And it's pretty tedious stuff because it's more about just the amount of time, especially cause they're trying to get their heart rate up. And so they just spend a lot of time doing that. And so they do have movies and stuff like that. You know, sometimes they have books, books on tape are pretty popular, you know, Audible, I'm sure gets a lot of workout up there.
For sure. Yeah, when I read his question, you know, I was thinking, you know, along the lines of the TV thing, I was like, yeah, I wonder, like, if they tried to, you know, like, if they were able to watch the Super Bowl or something, you know, not watch a lot of TV, but maybe these, like, bigger things, but yeah, probably not then, so.
I think for special events like that, sometimes they, you know, they find a way to do it through the internet.
Oh, yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Or maybe after the fact. I mean, they're on a kind of a weird sleep schedule. It's, like, halfway between Houston time and Moscow time as a compromise because they have mission control centers in both cities and they're on the opposite sides of the world.
Right.
So, and ISS, I mean, ISS sees a sunrise every 90 minutes. So they kind of get to choose whatever arbitrary day-night cycle they want because they're not, you know, they can't go by the natural one when they're up
there. Sure.
So yeah, they're on a weird time zone, but it works.
All right, and then I wanted to ask, because I think we're nearing the half hour. Yeah,
this went by really fast.
What's that?
This went by really fast.
Yeah, it did, for sure. I mean, it just, they always do. I feel like even the first one, it was like, it just flies by. But I wanted to ask if there's something people should be sort of on the lookout for. I mean, not, you know, within the next year, but let's say within the next, I don't know, 15 to 20 years. Is there any breakthrough that might reignite people's interest in space again, you know, the way it was in the 60s? Is there anything on the horizon that people can sort of look forward to?
Yeah, I'd say within the next 5 years.
Okay.
You're going to see commercial spaceflight. So it's already started. I mean, SpaceX sent the Dragon capsule up to the station last year. That was the first time a commercially built and owned, that was the main thing, commercially owned vehicle had docked with the space station and delivered cargo under a NASA service contract. And they're going to go again in April. And then again, I think another time later in the year. And then, you know, going on, and then within probably the next 4 to 5 years, a few different companies are building vehicles that will take humans up to the station. And those will be privately owned vehicles. So the difference is that NASA doesn't own it. NASA just buys the seats, and presumably for a lot less than they're paying the Russians right now.
Right.
And that alone probably won't be a huge difference to the public, because it still looks like a NASA mission. You've got this vehicle full of NASA astronauts. They're going up to the NASA International Space Station, and they're doing the same kinds of things. The vehicle will look different, so there'll be a lot of attention because, hey, it's a new space shuttle, or it's a new Apollo capsule, you know, or something that looks like those. But the mission will be pretty similar, and the thing that's really going to capture the imagination is basically like the Spaceship One and the Lynx X-Core stuff, because these guys are building vehicles that go to space, but they don't go to orbit. So they go up to space, and then they basically shoot straight up on a rocket. And then they go up as high as they can, and at the very top of their peak, they're at zero velocity. And they hang up there for a couple of minutes because there's not a whole lot to bring them down. Like, there's drag from air, but the air is so thin up there that it takes a while for it to slow it down and start to bring it back down again. And so then they'll tip their noses forward, and then they'll come in all the way back down, and it will be a very scary ride, a very scary, steep ride gliding all the way back down to Earth. But while they're up there at the very top, they will be in basically free fall. So you'll be able to get out of your seat, presumably, at least in some of the vehicles, and float around. And I mean, you will be in space. You will see the curvature of the Earth, and, it'll be kind of like the Alan Shepard flights from the very, very early 60s. And, you know, I think that's going to be really exciting for people. And those vehicles are being designed to do that for about $10,000 a trip. Or, no, excuse me. It's about $100,000 to $200,000 per trip, which is a hell of a lot of money, but it's a lot cheaper than millions and billions of dollars that it has been in the past. And there's a lot wider market. And the idea is that as they do it more and more, it becomes cheaper because of economy of scale, from producing the rocket engines and the vehicles. And then also it will introduce enough excitement that more competitors will come in, and then something terrible will happen and the government will get involved, and then we'll get set back a year while they investigate. I mean, this is how things go, but this is basically it mirrors very much the beginning of commercial airlines back in the 20s. And that's kind of the model that everyone's trying to follow. They're trying to do it in a safe way, but also an affordable way. And that's when, like, real people, I mean, rich people, yes, but people who are not trained, who are not, you know, military astronauts, they're not even civilian trained NASA astronauts, just regular people who happen to have a lot of money, mm-hmm. Including, I'm sure, a lot of, like, you know, lottery winners and people like that, will be able to go to space. And then space becomes a very different concept in the popular culture than it is right now. It becomes no longer a government program. It becomes a place that you can go on vacation.
Exactly. It becomes accessible. Yeah.
And, you know, and that's going to be a really big deal. And it's been on the cusp of happening for a while now, but the Spaceship Two, which is probably going to be the first one to do it, has been delayed for various reasons. They had a really bad accident out at Scale Composite in California, and they've been recovering from that and making some modifications. Probably, it looks like, I guess the last thing that I've seen in the news is that sometime in 2014, they should start actual commercial flights. And they're totally booked up. They have been for a long time. They've got deposits from like 500 people. But they're going to start sending up a lot of celebrities and, you know, athletes and very famous rich people are going to go up there. They're going to come back and go on David Letterman and talk about it.
Sure.
That is the next really big deal, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Athletes, especially. I mean, I could definitely say. I mean, right? You just see like LeBron James tweeting pictures from space or something. I mean, that makes sense. And then you're right; it just sort of catches on and builds from there. And then eventually, it's a ride at Six Flags.
He probably won't tweet from space because I don't think those vehicles will have satellite connections to do.
That's
it.
True.
And they won't be up there for very long anyway. So, but he's going to take the pictures and tweet them when he gets back down.
When he lands, absolutely. Yeah.
And it'll be like skydiving; like it'll be a really scary thing that you'll have to psych yourself up for. But it's hopefully relatively safe. You know, it's something that people will actually aspire and want to do.
And then eventually, well, videos of people getting married in free fall this kind of stuff.
Playing Monopoly, everything you can think of. Yeah.
For sure.
It's going to be awesome.
So look forward to that. Any rich listeners that we have, let us know your plans. And maybe, you know, buy a ticket for a couple of us here. We wouldn't mind it.
Hey, Scott, we should do another one of these pretty soon because we only got through like half the questions and there's some really good ones. So I want to do this more.
Cool. Yeah, maybe within the next month or so even we'll come back and revisit this. And if you have any questions that you didn't already submit, you can always do so at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com or through the Nintendo World Report forums, or even just tweet myself or Dr. Jonathan Metz here.
For sure.
I'm OK Soda. Johnny, what's your Twitter handle?
I'm Johnny Metz with no H and no Z.
There you go. Easy enough. And two N's. And, yeah, well, thanks for being here. I'm sure you don't mind coming on to talk about this stuff. So
I love this, man.
It wasn't a chore. And, yeah, we'll talk to you guys later.
Peace.
Bye.
Excuse me, Dr. Aldrin. I'm sorry, there wasn't a door, so I just...
I don't believe in barriers because I always break them. I see you. I see what you're doing. Return to the night. You've no business here.
Are you yelling at the moon?
I'm sorry. She and I just... I get mad sometimes.
What am I doing?
I'm sorry if I've disappointed you. Would you like to yell at the moon with Buzz Aldrin?
Yes, please.
I own you!
You dumb moon!
I walked on your face!
Don't you know it's day? Idiot!